right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Hey guys, on the line, it's Danny Scherson, former Army major. He was in Iraq War II and Afghanistan. He wrote the book Ghost Riders of Baghdad, and he's written all over the place for everything important on the internet, including and especially antiwar.com, and where he is a contributing writer, and whatever we call him. And also, the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. And this one is called The Tortured Legacy of the Mexican-American War, Part 1, which means I've only read Part 1, not Part 2 and 3, but I want to hear the whole thing. So go ahead, Mr. Former History Professor at West Point, and tell us all about the Mexican-American War.
Well, you know,
oh, I forgot to say, welcome to the show, Danny. How are you?
Thanks for having me. And, you know, I'm always happy to geek out a little. So Mexican War is great.
Yeah. And you know what? This is one that I know a little bit about because I did read Zinn. And I know a little bit about it other than that, too. But, I'm sure happy to hear all about it all over again. So please go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I got a very different take on the Mexican-American War as I read past the sort of triumphalist histories, especially in grad school, and then having the opportunity to teach it. And, you know, I do a lot of historical analogy pieces, and anybody who specializes in anything or has an interest in anything wants to tell you that their war or their subject is the one that's, you know, most relevant to today. So, you know, that can be exhausting. But I think that on a number of levels, while there aren't, you know, perfect parallels in history and there aren't perfect lessons to be learned, the Mexican-American War is not only fascinating in its own right, but does have certain significant parallels to today. So what do I mean? Well, we're talking about an era of regime change wars, right? The first American regime change of a, you know, large fellow republic, which is, you know, interesting, a flawed republic, of course. And, you know, we kind of like picked the rulers of some Barbary pirate states a little bit during Jefferson, but for the most part, this is the big regime change war. There's a race factor. There's an internal sort of civil war factor in the United States, mainly political. There's massive political dissent. There's even a significant amount of military dissent, up to and including, you know, mutinies and folks joining the other side, you know, from the American army. And it really does divide the nation. You know, Emerson said something to the effect of, you know, we'll win the Mexican War, but it'll be, you know, basically the poison, that victory, that will divide the nation. You know, of course, the Civil War comes later, and his prediction came true. It's sort of the end of a two-party system, or the first or second two-party system in America, the Whigs and the Democrats. The reason it ends is not only because they became so tribal, but because it became so regional. And so I'll get to that. But, you know, there used to be Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats and Northern Whigs and Southern Whigs. And, you know, after the Mexican War, there wasn't much of that at all. And so, to, you know, I'll start quick, but then kind of let you guide it. I mean, the thing to keep in mind as we think about Iraq and God, how many American wars, the Mexican-American War, which was an invasion, which was ultimately an occupation that everyone forgets about that part for, you know, several months, like a military occupation, civil disorder, all this, guerrilla war, but and a regime change, quite literally. And it was all sold on false pretenses, the whole shebang. We made war inevitable through, you know, the posturing of our military on the border and actually crossing the internationally recognized border, but also just political rhetoric and dealings with the Native Americans, and then just, you know, annexing Texas, which, you know, was still considered Mexican territory by most countries in the world and certainly by Mexico. So, you know, we set the war up, we set the conditions, we drive Mexico to the point of war. But then even when the, you know, casus belli kind of happens, the president, Polk, you know, who's a true believer, by the way, you know, he says, well, American blood was spilled on American soil. And what he's referring to is that some American cavalrymen, you know, about a dozen of them, were killed. But the problem is that he said American blood on American soil. Well, it's true that American blood was shed. What's not so clear is that that American blood was shed on American soil because, you know, this was, you know, south of the Nueces River, which was the recognized border and not the Rio Grande at the time. So it was really iffy across the board.
Wasn't it the San Jacinto?
Actually, it was a lie. No.
It was the Nueces. Okay.
Yeah, it was the Nueces.
You're embarrassing the hell out of me. I'm from here.
No, go ahead. But San Jacinto is, of course, interesting because that goes back to the Texan War. So, you know, for now, my point is that we set the conditions for war, we ginned it up, and then we actually, at the moment of conflict, we lied about it, right? The president lied about it. And
you know, what's interesting about that, too, just makes it easy to remember also, is that Abraham Lincoln helped make himself famous by making a big deal about this on the floor of the U.S. House, and they nicknamed him Spotty Lincoln. Like, this is a nickname that he got making fun of him for saying, wait a minute, which spot on the map did this skirmish take place again? On this side of the line or that side of the line? It's kind of relevant.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the things I say in the first section is that, like, the Mexican-American War, this largely forgotten war, kind of defines or helps define the careers of five American presidents. And so the one is a former president, John Quincy Adams. One of his finest hours is, you know, totally intransigent and unwilling to go along with this war. When the rest of the Whigs, who remind me a lot of our Democrats, when the rest of the Whigs folded over the Mexican War, right? He wouldn't, right? There was, like, I think about a dozen of them, and I forget what they called them. They were basically the intransigents, you know, they weren't going to have it, like the insufferables. And he led that. And I mean, John Quincy Adams dies basically on the floor of the House. Okay. He's like carried away after he has like an aneurysm. And what he was doing in that moment was loudly yelling no, refusing to even pass like an end of war legislation that was totally symbolic. All it was going to do was like basically thank the generals for their patriotic service in the war. And he wouldn't even do that. He was like, this is a bad war. This is a lie. This is evil. You know, so that's Quincy Adams.
I didn't know that story, that was how he died.
Dude, it's a wild story. It's in my last segment. But yeah, you can look it up. There's a lot of good books that cover it. But Amy Greenberg is one of the newer ones. So then you got Polk, right? So Polk is the Democratic president. He's they called him Young Hickory because he was a protege and an admirer, almost a fawning admirer of, you know, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson. So he kind of is actually handpicked as a dark horse to become the Democratic president, handpicked, I mean, by Jackson, and does get the nomination, wins. He's an odd guy for a number of reasons. One of them is that he says and follows through that he's only going to run for one term, you know. But he also is very political and wants the Democrats to succeed him. You know, he doesn't want like the Whigs to take charge. But he's a true believer from all intents and purposes. He works hard. He's got a wife who's almost a little bit like a feminist, and he like lets her help him with decisions, which is weird given his background, as you know, he's a Southerner and a Tennessee guy. But, you know, Polk's a true believer. He's a manifest destiny, sea to shining sea, you know, appoints political generals, all that. So then you got three future presidents, Zachary Taylor, who commands the Northern Army, the one that's, you know, along the Texas border. He becomes a Whig president. Most of the generals in the army at the time were Whigs, actually the professional generals, even though Taylor commanded a lot of volunteers and militiamen. And then you got Grant, and Grant's interesting because it's his first war. And his quote is that it was a wicked war, and that he had a terrible time of the Mexican War, and he felt awful about it. And the quote he said is, "But I had not the courage to resign." So Grant was anti-war in his first war. Now, he didn't, you know, become a conscientious objector, but for the rest of his life, it really bothered him. And he spoke about it just constantly, you know, especially later in life. And then finally, Lincoln, who you brought up, right? Old Spotty Lincoln. Lincoln kind of makes his career initially during his opposition to the Mexican-American War, but actually in the short term, it hurts him. So Lincoln's from Illinois, and he's from he represents Illinois. He's a freshman, class of 1848, end of the war, Whig, in a district and in a state that is highly pro-war. For the most part, the South and what was called the West at the time, was really the Midwest today, was highly pro-war. He's told by his friends, you know, go easy on this anti-war thing. You're going to lose your seat. And yet he does what you mentioned in his first floor speech, which was traditionally the freshmen kind of are like seen but not heard. And their first floor speech is kind of conservative and, you know, not very intense. Instead, he calls the president out, you know, and says that, he the whole thing is a lie. Lincoln does lose his seat. He's a one-term congressman. And exactly what happened, what could be expected to happen, happened. But of course, he, you know, builds that into a career that's imperfect, but at oftentimes built on a degree of principle. And it's an interesting moment for him. And then the final guy worth mentioning, I promise, is the last one is Clay, who's probably, you know, in some ways he's like the Hillary Clinton or something of his day, in the sense that he's like the most qualified person not to be president, right? Or whatever, you know, I mean, I'm not a Hillary Clinton fan, but, you know, the people say that. And Clay, you know, ran 3 or 4 times. And Clay's son, another difference from today, right? Clay's son dies. He's like a colonel. And, you know, he his favorite son volunteers and is killed in combat. And big deal. You know, it was big news at the time. And, you know, it's probably his finest moment, too, where, you know, he sort of, especially after the death of his son, he'd been like somewhat cautious early on, although he had like hinted again about his opposition to the war, but he challenges it very strongly. In fact, one of the most famous anti-war speeches by a prominent politician he gave in Lexington, Kentucky, which is where his wife was from. It's where he's from. And it's like a very famous speech. I mean, everybody's there. It's like a million hours, but it's really good if you have the time to read it. Well, on his way to Washington to take his seat as a freshman congressperson, stopping in town, sort of happens to happen, is a young Abraham Lincoln, whose wife, Mary Todd, is from the area, is from the same place in Kentucky as Clay. Lincoln hears the speech, is blown away by it. He's already a Henry Clay aficionado. He calls him like his idol early in life. And a lot of folks have speculated on the effect that it obviously had on Lincoln. And Lincoln does write some of it down in his diary of how profound it was. So, look, there's just a lot of stuff happening in the Mexican War. And so I could make it a story on just how fascinating it is. But and we can go in whatever direction you want next. But what I would say is a lot of this fascination and coincidence is almost too good to be true and therefore worth telling. But it's actually pretty relevant to some of like the forever wars and the lies and the regime change and the internal politics of anti-war to the extent that it exists today.
Yeah. Here's where I want to go. Here's what I want to know. What happened to the Mexicans?
Yeah, that's an important question. No one really ever talks about the Mexicans, right? We put their name in the war. We even put them first, right? We even front-loaded them in the name of the war. But they're not reported on very often until more recent scholarship. I've gotten into a lot of arguments over social media about this article because a lot of folks, you know, want to say, oh, you know, you're saying America's bad and, you know, you're not pointing out the flaws in Mexico. Of course, they haven't read the next 3 parts, so they don't know that I do, in fact. Well, the point is Mexico is they're a weak and new republic, and they are very fractured at the outset. They have had strong men, but then they've also had more liberals. They're very divided politically at home. And Mexico doesn't even really have a firm grip on, you know, the northern provinces that we later annex, right, which become California, New Mexico, and all this, and Texas. They have a very tenuous hold on that. In fact, they can barely fight off the Apaches and the Comanches. I mean, the northern Mexican settlements are getting wiped out, and there's like a great migration south back towards Mexico City. The Indians are winning in many cases, which makes the job of the American army easier, which explains some of the early victories, especially out west. Mexico is the war in the north, the original theater for the first year, which is Zachary Taylor, the fighting just south of Texas, goes pretty well for the Americans, although the Mexicans fight gallantly, actually, throughout this war, by the way. They fight gallantly. But, you know, it's slow, and it's a long march to Mexico City and tough terrain and desert and all this. So the Winfield Scott, another famous, West Pointer and general who runs but doesn't win the presidency, he leads the first ever major American army amphibious invasion, one of the great logistical feats. Frankly, I mean, the Duke of Wellington said it was like the greatest logistical feat like of the time, right? So because he was still alive. And so then he marches to Mexico City, and like all the guys who become famous Civil War generals, you've heard of them, right? Robert E. Lee, George Pickett, all these guys are there, and some of them make big names for themselves. Pickett's like this flamboyant guy who charges up Chapultepec, which is like this fortress. But Mexico City falls. Now here's where it gets interesting. No one ever talks about this part of the war. The story usually ends with the fall of Mexico City, but the Americans have nobody to surrender to them. Because the kind of temporary dictator back in power after his fall at the Alamo and San Jacinto, Santa Anna, he's gone. And there's this like division between the conservative oligarchs and the liberals, so to speak, in Mexico City. And oh, by the way, the Mexican people, a whole bunch of them don't quit. And the guerrilla war continues. And actually lots and lots of Americans are killed, ambushed, right? In addition, all the guys that died of disease. And Scott's down there. With the State Department rep, basically, this guy Nick Slidell, who was sent by Polk but eventually abandons Polk, and they want to make peace as fast as possible and get the heck out of Dodge because it's not going so great for the Americans down there. And it turns out that running a messy, broken republic on the verge of civil war, sound familiar, is difficult. Eventually, they cobble together against the wishes of Polk, who wants a harder peace bargain, wants to take even more of Mexico, wants even more, you know, doesn't want to pay them anything and all this. They basically make a deal on the ground, largely because there's no internet and good communications, so there's a lot of distance, and they cobble together sort of like a liberal coalition, and they make peace with it, of course, take the northern third plus of Mexico. But the story, even in the more sophisticated scholarship, ends there. But Mexico doesn't ever really recover, you know, for quite a long time. I don't remember the numbers, although I think it's in one of my later segments. You know, they go through an enormous amount of governments, presidents, and all this over the course of really the next 70 to 80 years. And of course, the Americans aren't responsible for all of that, but we certainly played a really great role, like we have in so many other countries, you know, some of which that I've occupied myself, in creating, fomenting the disorder that really made this young republic. Remember, it was only 25 years old at the time of the war. So America ends up having to intervene, and famously, you know, in the Banana War era, several times around the turn of the century, dealing with some of this disorder and like civil war that follows through. And I'll just say, finally, in the immediate aftermath, or relatively immediate aftermath, around the time of our civil war, Mexico, which has gone through all these presidents and governments and goes massively into debt to the Europeans, is invaded by France, right, with some help from the British in the 1860s, and occupied by the French army for quite some time. And a Austrian, you know, kind of second son prince, Maximilian, is put in charge of the Mexican throne for several years until his government falls to Benito Juarez and he's executed by firing squad. Point is, you know, Mexico becomes what we would now call like a failed state that requires, quote unquote, requires intervention from outside powers, all of which ends very poorly, both for the outside powers and, of course, especially for the Mexicans. So long answer, but I think that's the most interesting part of the story. No one talks a damn thing about.
Yeah, call it blowback. Hey, man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver, is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past, too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to ScottHorton.org/donate. Hey, guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and save $500.
Hey, so
You mentioned earlier offhand, but then went a different direction. But I wish you'd elaborate about these American Army deserters who, as you say in the article, went AWOL in numbers that make the Vietnam War pale in comparison. And not only that, but they actually, not all of them, but some of them didn't just leave, but they switched sides in the war. How could that be?
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, starting with the smaller stuff, although it's prominent. Okay. So the highest per capita casualty rate of American, of any American war, Mexican war. I mean, who knows that, right? Just in terms of between disease and combat death and how small the numbers involved, because our army was relatively small, even with the augmentation of the militias. It's a massive, it's a death factory, Mexico. I mean, guys just don't come back. Massive amounts of GI resistance, 8% desertion rate, you know, highest ever in American war. Vietnam pales in comparison. And then a few hundred, more than a few, less than several hundred, mostly Irish Catholic immigrants who populated the regular army in huge numbers throughout the period and well into the Indian Wars of the late 19th century, they joined the enemy. The part of it is the way they were treated in the American army and the way they were treated as immigrants. You know, the Irish were, you know, depicted as apes at this time, largely in American political cartoons. And also just the Catholic heritage had some effect, and Mexican propaganda, which, you know, there is sort of a latent and not so latent strain. I can even speak to some extent up till today of like underdog, anti-imperial, anti-oppression in the Irish character, which was probably even stronger then. And so this like Mexican propaganda, which had been calling and targeting, especially the Irish and Catholic immigrants, hey, you're on the wrong side, like you're the invader. It works on a huge number. I mean, I don't think there's another instance besides, you know, the revolution, which is more of a civil war. I don't think there's another instance of a large enough group going AWOL from the American Army that they formed their own battalion, the San Patricio Battalion, the St. Patrick's Battalion. And they fight marvelously for the Mexican Army with incredible courage. Most of them die in combat. They bring special skills to the Mexican Army because the thing that the American Army was best at, right? The Mexicans were equally brave and sometimes more. The thing that we had over them was engineering skills and even more so artillery. And so the San Patricio guys were able to like help the Mexicans with that. So they were considered very useful, but most die in combat because they know what's going to happen to them if they surrender. So in some cases, Mexican soldiers retreated and the St. Patrick's guys fought to the end. Those who were captured, I don't have the stats in front of me, but suffice it to say that many, like scores were executed by the American Army for treason. Some had their sentences commuted to, you know, life in prison. And the Mexicans to this day have a lot of monuments and celebrate the St. Patrick's Battalion as heroes. So this was interesting. And you know, we talk today about military dissent around whether it's these protests or the COVID response or the wars. And, you know, there's a lot of generals who've come out, and I'm skeptical of these folks, even when I agree with what they say. But yeah, the generals were critical of the war. Scott and Taylor are the two major generals while active in service. They didn't like go public against the war, but they were critical of Polk's policy. They leaked a lot of stuff. They fought him tooth and nail about strategy. They were even dubious about the, you know, efficacy of the war. At the mid-level and the lower level, the lieutenants and captains in particular, you know, there's even more rumblings. Most stay on and do their duty, but Grant's the most famous guy who was wildly just turned off by what he saw in Mexico. But it is important to note that, you know, I think of like the 40 odd major battles in the Civil War, I think 39 were commanded by like a West Pointer on both sides. The exact numbers are easy to Google, but it's staggering. Well, what they don't mention is that, you know, 95 or more percent of those generals who we often list for their West Point credentials were also Mexican War veterans, most of whom were on that triumphant march from Veracruz to Mexico City with General Scott and General Lee, who is much in the news for all the Confederate naming. Was a lieutenant and then a captain, and in probably the most important battle campaign to get around a major Mexican, you know, defensive position on the way to Mexico City, personally scouted like a impossible path, like around the Mexican lines, and is, you know, mentioned in his dispatches. And so, you know, he makes his name. And I mean, you name a famous Civil War general, and I can basically tell you that he was in Mexico, and maybe even tell you a little something about it. And it's really important. It's the major combat experience for the guys who become the generals in the war.
Yep. That's the history of American history right there, is wars and then generals moving to political prominence. Lots and lots of that. But now, so help me remember, right? Because I mentioned Howard Zinn earlier there, and there's something very memorable about the Mexican-American War there, although I'm not certain now. It's been so many years since I read it, who it was. But I think maybe it was Taylor who had written in his diaries or in letters back home or something during the war that this is absolutely disgusting what we're doing and the atrocities and the aggression, and I just can't stand it. I hate it so much. Do you remember what I'm talking about there?
Yeah. So Taylor's private correspondence is very skeptical of what we're doing in Mexico. A lot of guilt, none of it public, and completely anti-Polk. I mean, the abhorrence that Taylor and Scott felt for Polk is really rivals the way a lot of these like retired generals seem to be so reflexively anti-Trump. I mean, not to create perfect analogy, but the persona of Polk was just bothersome in the extreme to a lot of these generals. Of course, like in most cases, we found this out later and they didn't really do anything about it. And, you know, Taylor rides his war hero status to become the Whig candidate and then victor in the, you know, 1848 election. So like right after the war. But like, let's think about this for a second. You want to talk about like cynicism and irony. The Whigs, who were dubious about the war from the start, but rolled over because they remembered what happened to the Federalists when they opposed the War of 1812, which is that they were destroyed as a party. They went away. I mean, they were totally discredited as traitors. So the Whigs had learned that lesson. So they go along with the war they don't believe in until a grassroots anti-war movement, the first in American history, really, at the grassroots, forms. And everyone knows about Thoreau and civil disobedience, but that was about Mexico. And then only then, just like our Democrats today and since Vietnam, then they jump on the bandwagon and co-opt the anti-war movement. But so then they become very anti-war. And it's probably the biggest, you know, political anti-war effort in American history up to that
point.
There's
a great parallel there with Iraq War I. It didn't quite destroy the Democratic Party, but Bill Clinton and John Kerry and Joe Biden had all opposed Iraq War I and then never lived it down and were so embarrassed by that. And of course, when Iraq War II came around, none of them were willing to make that same mistake again. So they made the opposite mistake by supporting it.
It's a great point. I mean, Bob Kerry of Nebraska, Navy SEAL Medal of Honor winner, was groomed and expected to be president in many ways. He was the perfect guy, right? He's from the Midwest, conservative state, but he's a Democrat. He's a war hero. But his opposition to the Persian Gulf War was largely considered to have made him, you know, untenable as a candidate. But, you know, my final point, I guess, on the Whigs is the irony. So the cynical Whigs who suddenly become massively anti-war, many of them principled, but most of it cynical, they then, in order to beat the Democrats right after the war, run one of the two hero generals from that war. And Taylor doesn't exactly like run on his anti-war credentials. He runs on the triumphalism of the fact that he's a national hero. And so the Whigs wanted power so bad, you know, that they ran a general. And there's just like a degree of irony there, you know, I think. And also just parallels the political calculus of the duopoly. And it's timeless.
And they almost did run Wesley Clark in 04. I mean, there's a pretty close parallel there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing, and you know, I don't know how long we have, but you know,
we have no more time at all. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll tell you, some other time we'll talk about the Alamo. I'm sure you're interested in that down in Texas.
I am, and you have a great write up on it, and I already know that you're absolutely right, which sucks.
Right.
But, it is what it is, and so we'll look forward to parts 2 and 3, of course. We might wait at antiwar.com and run them all together or something. The Tortured Legacy.
I wish they would do that. I wish that they would run them all together. But yeah, it's good together.
Yeah, FFF likes to do parts. The Tortured Legacy of the Mexican-American War. Danny Scherson at FFF.org. Thanks again, bud.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Always glad to do it.
The Scott Horton Show, Antiwar Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.